Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Football on Off the Ball.
He deserves enormous credit for recognising that after 8 and a bit years at Liverpool, he was running out of energy, and rather than waiting for things to go bad, he got out.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Now then, I dare say the Dodger, DJ Carey and the Great Betrayal is going to absolutely fly off the shelves over the next 6 to 8 weeks in the build-up to Christmas. It has the potential to be one of the most appealing crossover books for Irish society since Champagne Football. The author is Eimear Vrenon and she is with me in studio. Eimear, how are you doing?
I'm good, Owen. It's lovely to be in studio here and to see this place in person.
It's great to have you here. How did you pick the photo on the cover? DJ looking over his shoulder.
That's a photo by Patrick Bulger from Info, and I was searching for photographs of DJ during my research, and the most important, I suppose, resource I had was all the articles that were published about DJ over the years, all the interviews he gave. There was something about this photo shoot, I think it was from 03, there was a darkness around it, and it's the way he's looking over his shoulder. Now it's cropped on that cover, you can't see the Liam McCarthy Cup, but he was holding it. And there was others, black and whites, from the same shoot that have been used in the Irish Times. And I just kind of bookmarked it. And I thought, I haven't actually managed to contact Patrick Bulger. I've sent him a message to say the lighting, everything in that photograph. And I'm a big fan of photography. I do think a picture is worth 1,000 words. I know, unfortunately for me, when I'm a writer, but it is. There's something about that photograph. There's more to DJ Carey and we didn't see it. And when I look at that photograph, with hindsight, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's perfect for what the contents inside represent. I'm interested in your own background here, Eimear, before we get into the nuts and bolts of the story here, because this is a man who has, I presume, been a figure in your life for quite some time. You've been working on the Southeast beat for a number of years, and you've worked in KCLR, and DJ Carey as a hurler and as an iconic sportsman is, I presume, something that was very familiar to you, even as a Carlow woman.
That's it. I didn't know DJ Carey on any personal level. My only dealings with him, few dealings really, all through media work. But he was on the radar. He was on the scene. I was fascinated by him because I love everything about the 90s. Just the whole vibe in Ireland at the time, Paul McGrath, Jackie's Army, the excitement, Oasis, the music, the sport. And DJ was in the mix. DJ was there because he was one of the biggest celebrities. He didn't need a surname. He also had something different about him. So, like, I'm not steeped in the GAA, being a Carlow woman, but I had a big respect for him because I thought he was more than a hurler. You know, he had something about him, the DJ factor, where he was able to get out of danger. People would go to see him from all over the country in Nolan Park. I mean, people from Antrim, people from Tipperary, people put their kids in the car and go down to Nolan Park to watch this superstar because he was just so fast and he had something that we hadn't seen it before, something special about him.
When did you first realise that there might be a different side to DJ Carey?
I worked as a young reporter in my 20s for the Irish Independent. Now, my beat was the Southeast. You might call me, you know, the correspondent that was in the area, the area where DJ Carey was from. So I thought, poor DJ, because at the height of his fame, there was a lot of stories around his business and how difficult things were for DJ in business. So he had a company called DJ Carey Enterprises that he set up in the mid-90s. And it was a small company, but he employed a number of people. He employed family members. He employed some former hurlers, teammates and that. And he had some success with that for a while. But then things went pear-shaped for him. And I think there were a lot of pressures, say, with the Celtic Tiger. He met Sarah Newman. they bought exclusive properties with eye-watering price tags in the K Club in Mount Juliet. And when the crash came, the banks, obviously, they had big mortgages on these properties. The properties were only worth a fraction of what they paid for them. And when all that came crashing down, the collapse of the Celtic Tiger, the loans being called in, DJ was under serious financial pressure. His relationship with Sarah Newman broke down in 2012. And obviously, she was very successful. She was a multimillionaire. Whereas DJ, you know, his business was on a smaller scale to that. So he had the fame, she had the money. So they were a Celtic Tiger couple. And where I come from, I suppose, DJ had been so sound to everybody. So sound to everybody. We had no reason to doubt him. He did lots of events. He didn't always even mention money. He often put the hand up and said the cup of tea is grand. He had more crystal clocks, he said himself, than anyone else in the country at the time. So people give him a gift, maybe, for driving for miles, for doing events. So I would have thought, sure, poor old DJ, here he is now, his business is after failing, he's under pressure. And there was always, it's only with hindsight, Owen, I didn't think much of it at the time, genuinely, other than God help him. But maybe it was always there, that he was prone to the dramatics and that there were a lot of sensational headlines when you put them all together. When you're looking in isolation, so I was writing about him in the Indo in 2012, briefly, stories about his business, stories about his relationship, the breakdown of his relationship with Sarah Newman, bit of background and colour on him. Sometimes with All-Ireland build-up, I might go into the village and do these kind of stories. But I didn't see anything else. But when I went back during my research for this, it was extraordinary. There was so much there about DJ Carey that I had never read. That I was probably a little bit young and only just on the scene of journalism, say, in 03. And so around that time, sports journalist called Dennis Walsh, who works for, I think at the time he worked for the Sunday Times, and he wrote about a vicious rumour that had swept the southern half of the country that DJ Carey had cancer. That was printed in a newspaper in 03. And Dennis actually asked DJ at the time, you know, could you why would there be a rumour like that? And the kind of answer he gave him was that he was sitting in Waterford Regional Hospital in a corridor and was spotted sitting outside the oncology ward. He was waiting for tests or for something, maybe an x-ray for stomach pains, and that somebody saw him there, and from there the cancer rumour was born. So there was always rumours about DJ, which when you think about it, a little bit odd. We wouldn't have devastating rumours of illness about everybody in Ireland. We see a lot of it now with AI, you know, weird stuff. But this was 2003, 2004, 2005. These kind of stories would swirl about DJ, and DJ would address them. He'd talk about them. And he would say, you know, we thought he was being persecuted, basically, as in the general public thought that.
Yeah, so if we're going to jump back and forward through the timeline, I suspect, throughout this chat. So the crash DJ Carey, the sort of economically challenged DJ Carey that people would have had maybe sympathy for before we realised what the reality of the situation might have been. How soon after that point, how soon after you're doing the All-Ireland build-ups with him, the picking up the phone to him to do the straight-up pieces with him, do you realise actually that there is something very, very shady going on here as a reporter?
I didn't realise until very late in the day. So I suppose my summation would be, I thought he was a bad businessman. That was at the back of my mind for a while. I also had heard he was ill. Now, he didn't tell me he was ill. I have his phone number. The phone, by the way, was confiscated by the Gardaí in 2023. I got other numbers for him. But I don't have any relationship with DJ Carey other than asking him to come on the local radio a few times and writing about him. But I started in 2022 to hear things and to pay close attention to them. And actually, after Paul Murphy's prime time on Katrina Carey, that's when people in Kilkenny and people in Carlow started to really talk a little bit differently about DJ Carey. They started to wonder about him because, you see, they thought he had cancer. Now, I wouldn't have known about the cancer part. I would have thought just some kind of illness or something going on. Didn't like to ask, didn't like to pry, because health issues, I mean, even hard-nosed news journalists don't pry in Ireland into somebody's health issue unless they're willingly talking about it themselves and exploring those details with you. It was just, there was something odd about, I overheard a conversation one day where somebody said, what the fuck is Carey at? And it was the way they said it. And then somebody else said to me, come here, sit down. And I was having a coffee in Connolly's Red Mills beside TJ Reid's gym. And it wasn't a hurler, by the way, so just in case anyone thinks it was, lots of people go in there for coffee. And the person just said to me, sit down, sit down. Knew, obviously, I was working in KCLR at the time, and said, do you hear about DJ? And I said, Katrina. And they said, no, DJ. And I said, what about DJ? He owes money all over town. And started naming well-known business people who'd be known to me in Kilkenny. And I'm not going to name them here because I couldn't substantiate some of these claims, by the way. And some of these people said, no, I'm not talking to you. And I didn't give DJ money. So who knows? And maybe they didn't give DJ money. You know, so-and-so gave him 50K. Did you ring him? This other fella, he gave him 20. And this person was throwing names and figures. And I said, why? Like, what are they giving him money for? And this, like, I don't know, like, we both thought he's in trouble. This person was trying to see, did I know why he was in trouble? I just kind of went away slightly bewildered. So the health stuff was always in the ether. And remember, and I know we're going back and forth, but there was high profile interviews. I mean, there was a Late Late Show appearance with Ryan Tuberty. There was an interview with Ray Darcy in 2015 where DJ explores his health issues. I had a front page story in the Indo about DJ in 2012 about his blood clots on his brain because he was telling people in Croke Park at an event that summer that he had had surgery in America for brain aneurysms or clots on his brain.
So when you start to uncover the things that DJ has started to proclaim, if we go back to the Dennis Walsh piece in 2003, for example, and he's spotted outside an oncology unit allegedly prior to Dennis Walsh talking to him about a potential cancer diagnosis. This comes from DJ telling people that he had to get some sort of surgery. However, in the book you describe how there's some confusion as to what exactly he's gone through here. Is it an appendix? Is it possibly actually tonsillitis? That in hindsight, all these contradictions start to come up, and this is one of the first big ones.
For any journalist out there who's ever covered a story on DJ Carey, they'll know this. It was always dramatic. And it was always hard to know. Like, some of it could be true. You'd get one version maybe close to the Careys, and then you'd get another version. And it was just odd things going on, just contradictions. Sometimes the story didn't add up. And actually, it was really helpful that so much information was on the record. So I'm not a GAA anorak, but I'll tell you, I went through all the GAA yearbooks for Kilkenny going back years, and I was really glad that there are anoraks out there, like Enda McAvoy, if I could mention him from the Irish Examiner, and a great local journalist as well for many years. And Enda, even as a young reporter, he was taking match reports and he was documenting the blinding speed of DJ Carey and how he burst onto the scene. And there's lots of information there. And press conferences, he covered one press conference after DJ's dramatic exit in 98, his retirement at only 27, caused shockwaves. And Enda went for the Munster Express, I read the piece in, I think, to the press conference when DJ Carey, within 6 weeks, announced he was coming back. It went gangbusters, and there was all these rumours again, always rumours. Rumours, was he paid to come back? Had the GAA given him some kind of inducement to get him back? Why had he changed his mind within 6 weeks? 6 weeks earlier, he was walking away from the game. He said he had enough, you know, and then he admitted it was one of his more stupid decisions, and all of a sudden he's back in for the championship and all the headlines are about DJ Carey.
There is a situation a couple of years post that, where DJ successfully sues the Sunday World and Sunday Independent. Is that over the claims that he was paid to come back, or was this a different story?
I contacted a former managing editor of the newspapers, and nobody could tell me exactly why. Now, there may be reasons for that, but there was a libel settlement, and I do know that DJ went off to Thailand in 2000 and, on the 2000 hurler's trip to Thailand in early 2001, and he went off there a happy man because he had that, you know, he had gotten that settlement. I don't know what the settlement was specifically in relation to.
Okay, right. Prior to that then, like, I'm sure you're plucking through different pieces of detail that maybe the people of Goran are giving you, maybe information about him and his family, his upbringing. Were there any warning signs about DJ Carey's deceit as an adult that were present in the early sections of his life?
Yes.
Go on.
So I spoke to his former school teacher and school principal, a lovely man. He was in DJ's corner. And that's important as well, because stories need balance. And also, I wasn't quite sure what was going on. You know, you can make assumptions sometimes and you don't want to be wrong. So his name is John Knox, and he was so proud of DJ. He was so proud of DJ. As a little boy, he taught him, and Charlie Carter, Pat O'Neill, they were all in Gore National School together. Just a few things I'll just pluck out, right? One thing John Knox said to me, there was a little nervousness about him as a boy. He wouldn't always show up for school, but he'd show up for the match. And then other things, like he wouldn't sit at the back of the bus. He'd normally sit up near the front with the adults. So he was a little bit different, maybe a little bit to the other boys. He wasn't wild. And even then, say, as a teenager, you know, hurlers in Kilkenny, they'd be in demand and there'd be plenty of women showing interest in Langtons. And maybe these days it'd be like selfies and stuff. Back then it wasn't. It was autographs. And DJ was a clean hero. You know, he wasn't mad on, he didn't drink, he didn't smoke. And he didn't have young ones hanging out of him or anything like that. He was, we'd say, somebody who was seen in the community as having such a good reputation. But I think within the camp sometimes there's fierce loyalty to him. I get it. I understand. If I was a Kilkenny hurler, you know, or like, you'd be the same. Because if he's your teammate, and he was people's teammate, he was a real team player. He was a remarkable team player. Like, there's evidence of that in many of his games. But in real life, I don't think he had very close relationships with those people. I think they saw that there was something odd. So things like looking for sympathy, maybe exaggerating injuries sometimes. I was told by people very close to the setup, definitely signs of that. People would be wondering what all the bandages were about. Mm. That he'd do weird things. Who knows? You know, he had injuries at times. He was at the height of his playing career. He was training several times a week. He was also driving around the country a lot. So you would be prone to injury, but just some of it, he's the most unfortunate man in Ireland for injuries.
Yeah.
And for crimes, actually, for being a victim of many crimes as well. There's a lot there.
That's it. And also other things that have happened to him, like around the same time, as I mentioned, regarding the claim that he made with regards to his appendix being removed, and then some suggestion contrary to that, that maybe it was actually his tonsils that he had to have removed. He claimed to have been in a car crash around this time as well. This is November 2001.
Yes, and the front page in the Irish Examiner, because Ireland's small, I know the journalist that wrote that, Nance McSweeney, and about Top Cat DJ, you know, Speedy Chase and all this, and Top Cat DJ, and, like, the detail of it is fascinating. DJ Carey claimed that he had a Beamer, right, worth 50 grand, around 50 grand. He went in to pay for his fuel in Crookstown in a service station, and he claimed that somebody took the car, and it seems they did, and sped off up the motorway, and he gave chase. Now, in the report in the newspaper says, like, there was Garda helicopter, there was all this, but eventually the Gardaí had to, you know, give up, that they'd lost the trail. But DJ and his sister continued in the car, and that they chased to some place in County Kildare, I think it was Selbridge, and that DJ said, "I wouldn't let him outrun me." Kind of ludicrous quotes along this line. He wasn't going to outrun me, and that he pinned down the assailant, but eventually your man got away. So just very colourful and very off the wall type quotes, I would say.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean the difficulty, Owen, is some of it could be true.
Correct.
Like the best lies.
Well, I presume some of it is true, and there is an addiction that he would have garnered from the attention that he would have got from these true crazy stories happening to him. And I'm sure a couple of them actually happened, but then you get that rush of, geez, look at me, look at the response to the story that I'm telling here. And then maybe a couple of them were crafted.
Who knows?
We do know a few more things, and we can go through them here. But one of the things that I think is an interesting...
Are you betting into the book?
Well, like, I mean, as I say, it's an extraordinary account of some extraordinary things. Like, it's an absolutely brilliant, brilliant read. I did wonder, when it comes to the key points in the early 2000s, how much you get to September 2003 and the reports of the marriage being over. How much of that is an impact on his behaviour after that? Because it does feel that there's a murkiness to that as well in terms of our clarity on when that actually does break down.
Yeah, so there's the newspapers reported the breakdown of his marriage to Christine, who he had married in 95 and had two boys with. The newspapers reported that on the All-Ireland Sunday, it was on the front pages, and even some of the days leading up to that, it was out, 2003. But it seems the marriage would have been over at least a year and a half before it hit the news, before it hit the press. So DJ Carey then started a relationship with a very successful businesswoman, Sarah Newman. So many of your listeners would remember Sarah Newman from Dragon's Den. So she was a huge entrepreneur. At this stage, maybe she didn't have the profile now of DJ Carey in Ireland, but she had the money. So DJ brought the notoriety. Sarah had the money. They started buying up properties in the K Club, exclusive resorts. She had a lot of money from a business deal. She sold her business, a hotel booking type business, in the dot-com bubble. Did very, very well. There's staggering reports of how much she got. Like, some of them I'd say are a bit off the wall. In reality, some of my sources are saying likely she would have got over 12 million for this deal, which is still huge money. But some papers reported between 30 and 60 million. And so that put him into a different stratosphere. So they start snapping up properties, Celtic Tiger Times, everybody was buying property, our obsession with property in the country. We went absolutely bananas. So they bought, they had five houses between them, two in the K Club, one in Mount Juliet, one in Almond Road in Monkstown, and one Chalet Grace, named after Sarah's daughter, in Zermatt, an exclusive ski resort in Switzerland, or in the Swiss Alps. So all that was going on. Now, this is where things get really tricky for them, because they paid huge sums for properties, and then what transpired was the values of the properties just absolutely dwindled, and all of a sudden they weren't worth a fraction of what they paid for them, and the banks called in the mortgages and they were under pressure to repay loans. So around 2012 we found out that the engagement was off. They were due to marry. Sarah Newman gave an interview to Niamh Horan in the Sindo, where she said that the bridesmaid dresses were picked, the venue was booked, and now all of a sudden the whole thing was called off. And at the time in 2012 she said DJ Carey decided to call time on the relationship. Now, you know, I would imagine there was a lot of detail she couldn't go into at the time. DJ Carey was huge in Ireland. It would be very difficult maybe to come out and air all of that, we'd say. So she gave a recent interview that offered more insight into the breakdown of that relationship and exactly what was going on. She discovered that DJ was telling people that he was ill. And yeah, there was some extraordinary details emerged.
That brings us nicely on to the number one question that people will have had this week, which is why? And if DJ was going around claiming that he was unwell at this point, the avenue was to get some financial compensation for what he was telling people. But if things were going okay with regards to the finances prior to that, or he was at least due to marry into a bit of money, let's say, why was there such a need for the cash at that point? Or were her financial, was her financial position going to be in real jeopardy given the falling property prices at that point?
There's some evidence that he was under pressure at times, like robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah.
So there was, if you think of it almost like a pyramid scheme, you know, trying to stay ahead of that. And I met one man that he said to me that he was he thought Sarah Newman was a lovely woman. And he said, like, he said, Emer, she didn't know at that stage at all. She did not know what he was up to. And he was, he gave him 10K in 2010. And he said to me that DJ said, don't tell Sarah about this.
Okay.
And he thought that was credible because he thought, as sound, DJ doesn't want to be worrying his partner. He didn't say cancer to this man. He said, I need the money to go to America to get tests because he was worried about his health. So he just gave it to him. Now, he subsequently, the man wanted that money back. There was no sign of it coming back. And he kind of got annoyed with DJ because 5 years later, he was seeing DJ was at the Augusta Masters and he was
living it up.
There was a bit of high life on his Facebook page. Your man was annoyed because he said, look, you know, he felt DJ was making a fool of him.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Yeah. In terms of the income that DJ was making for himself, like this maybe goes hand in hand with the breakdown of his marriage, because you have DJ Carey Enterprises, which people will be familiar with, the selling of detergents and cleaning supplies and paperware as well. So his wife is a director on the company up until the point of the marriage breaking down, or is there actually a bit of a time lag there before DJ's sister gets involved?
Well, she stepped back, I presume, around the time the relationship failed, yes. Yeah. And then Katrina stepped into the fold. And then sometime later, the company, there was serious issues with the company, unauthorised transactions, where there was about €200,000 that was missing, say, a hole in the accounts. Now, Sarah Newman, meanwhile, was trying to pump money into this business to try and help save it. And DJ, you know, at that stage was, I'd say, glad of the financial assistance from Newman. He was saying that he was trying to save the business as well. But ultimately, Sarah called in the Gardaí, the revenue, the auditors, and they don't seem to have a definitive conclusion, or they didn't seem to have any definitive conclusion as to what actually happened to the missing money in the accounts. And just that, eventually, anyway, the business folded and the business failed. And I presume a file did go to the DPP, but didn't go anywhere.
Okay. What then are we talking about with regards to the timeline of the two people who you speak to under pseudonyms in the book, the people that DJ would have met on Plenty of Fish, I think, is when he meets the first person who's in question here. So Jane, what sort of timeline are we talking here?
Is 2013.
So Sarah
Newman was out of the picture at this stage. Okay. DJ was living a fairly solitary life in the K Club still. So there was a little period of time before the repossessions, or before he lost the K Club. And so he was there for a period of time. And during 5 months of that, he met a woman.
How quickly does she realise that DJ is going to be in the activity of trying to get money out of her?
Very quickly.
Okay.
So soon into the relationship, DJ told the woman that he had cancer and that he needed money for treatment abroad. Some of the things didn't make sense. But you see, at the start of the relationship, it was very exciting because he was DJ Carey, and this woman's family even introducing DJ to people she knew. This was great. Like, she went to events with him, felt like a superstar, because he was held in such high esteem. Like, you've just pictured, like, 2013. This is the year DJ launched his official autobiography written by Martin Breheny. Lots of information in there as well. It's really fascinating reading it back. And he launched it. So he was, years after his retirement, he was still really able to command such attention that he was able to bring that book out in 2013. So she went places with him, but she noticed odd things about him. Again, I'm using words like odd and strange, because they were, like, some of it was absolutely cracked when you think back, but maybe at the time, see, we know a lot more now about tech and digital stuff, and it seems very primitive, even.
Yes.
2013, to be fair, right? So I would say, like, would you not try and ring him when he was abroad? And she said, no, well, I wouldn't really ring him, he'd ring me. And one time she was suspicious, and the more suspicious she got and the more questions she asked, the more of the cold shoulder she got off Carey. And she gave me really interesting details. Now, I find this stuff fascinating, like him standing on his tippy toes to appear taller in photographs. Like, I was zooming in on photographs to see if this was true, because she was telling me things about him that would just give you more insight into his character, and how he would criticise her about wearing too much makeup, and just little things like that, that eventually, anyway, the relationship failed, and not before he had taken her for a sum. We'll say 17,000, I suspect, maybe a little bit more, but 17,000 certainly, And then she put him under huge pressure because she knew, she just after a while knew that he wasn't legit, and she got paid back in dribs and drabs with cheques from Kilkenny. So this is where I was saying earlier about robbing Peter to pay Paul, perhaps. These kind of stories, they feed into that as well, you know, that cheques were coming back and forth and somebody else would pay and then he'd be able to pay somebody else back.
Another woman who's named in the book as Alison delivers like a really, really powerful chapter in the book. So at this point, he tells her that he has terminal cancer. Like, is this actually his line to everybody prior to this, or does he ratchet it up?
It depends. Depends who you are. He's very clever, despite what so many people have said to me. No, Eimear, you're wrong about him. He's Walter Mitty. He's thick as the ditch. He's this, he's that. And I kind of thought, I'm not sure, because he was meticulous with his planning and his execution. The way he was on the hurling field, he was very precise. He had a price in your head and he knew your net worth. And he was like cold calling people. He was bulk texting people, trying to get money from them. It was fairly frantic at times. Now, there was a period, say, between 2014, when he started splashing the cash a little there for a year, going on the holidays and stuff, where he seemed to have been getting a lot of generous support.
Okay, and that's obviously because the cancer story is out there. It's not really being publicly reported, but it's kind of generally accepted that it's very, very serious.
And I'm sorry, Owen, went a bit off topic, but the cancer story evolved. So there were times when it was brain cancer. And just because you'll be interested in sports people in this, there was a time when he met Asian Games officials around 2013 in Croke Park, in the Croke Park Hotel. And he told them, and he nearly floored them, that he had brain cancer around then. Now, go further back, and he had said to the man that I met about giving him the 10K in 2010, he had said, didn't mention cancer, but said he was going abroad for treatment. Said to others in the K Club bar, sometime between 05 and 10, he had marks on his head and he was showing them and talking about brain clots and aneurysms and different things. And then move forward, and in recent years, multiple myeloma is the cancer he chose, and in great detail. Now, I would find some of it hard to believe, genuinely, only the victims in this case are extraordinary and they are very credible people. Like, one of them has a brilliant business. She's quite high profile herself in the southeast. She owns Goat's Bridge Trout Farm, Mag Kerwin, and she's successful. I just happen to know her because Carol Kilkenny is small. The scene is small. People know each other. I'd interviewed her about her business on the radio before. And DJ Carey actually targeted Mag's husband, Jer, on the side of a hurling field in Thomastown, saying, "I have the same cancer as your wife." And it was during COVID when the rules were relaxing and when the kids were so excited to get back out training again. Jer was down in the field and all the lads were thinking, this is great, we've DJ coming, because he was a juvenile ambassador for the sport, hoping he'd show an interest in the young fellas, and this is huge for them. But he just did a beeline for Jer, and it was all about, and Jer thought, God, what a nice guy. He had no idea. He said, I had the same cancer as your wife. And Jer took out his iPhone. So I sat down with Jer and Mag in the last couple of years and went through some of this stuff. And fair play to him, he was very meticulous, because in the notes in his iPhone, he put in Fred Hutch, Cancer Centre, Seattle. Because DJ was after telling him where he got his treatment and how great it was, and to pass this on to Mag and all this. He'd never been there. I contacted the Fred Hutch Cancer Centre, Seattle. Now, obviously, doctor-patient confidentiality. My first request wasn't very successful. They don't talk about specific
But it
patients.
Is a real place.
However, DJ was saying to people that he was getting in there for free because of his elite sporting status, because he was a world handball champion. He had those world titles. He actually said this to people. He said it to some high-profile people as well, that he said to one that customs stopped him on the way into America once and said, oh, you're an elite sportsman, so you get free, like, Medicare, you get free treatment over here, right? He told that story to somebody who I spoke to. So I went back to the Fred Hutch Cancer Centre in Seattle and I said, do you have a scheme for elite sporting athletes that would entitle them to free medical treatment? No.
That was one of a number of flags. Did they ever give you the full on sort of, we've never spoken to this man before, they wouldn't have been allowed to?
Oh, the first request, I had to go away and think.
Yeah.
So the first, obviously, doctor-patient confidentiality, I got a standard type response that you get from the HSE or any body, any medical, any hospital who cannot discuss these issues. And this is part of this fraud as well, because in journalism, it can be very hard to substantiate. You know, if somebody tells you they are sick, if the horse's mouth tells you they're sick, you tend to give them the benefit of the doubt, because who do you check
Ireland.
With? You can't check with the doctor. Doctor can't tell you.
Yeah.
So if you were to tell me about your heartbreaking story, we generally take you at your word.
Can we go back then to Alison, because she notices some serious inconsistencies in his behaviour. Obviously, she's operating under the proviso that he's got terminal cancer. He's liberally taking money for her. And I think gaslighting is probably the best way to describe DJ's behaviour towards Alison, particularly when he's spotted around Ireland in different locations when he's supposed to be in Seattle.
It's really humiliating. And I think I'm really grateful to these women for finding ways of communicating at times with me. And also for people around them as well, because it's such a small area and it's really difficult on a story like this with somebody of DJ's stature. People were really frightened to tell the truth. So in the case of Alison, not her real name, but she discovers DJ again, the word she used, and I try to ask a question when I'm interviewing somebody not using the word the last person said to me, but she said again, an odd man, a very odd man. I was like, how is he odd? You know, and people would tell me things about him. Others would tell me things as well, that the plasters, they looked like women's heel protectors, and he would put them on his lower neck, that he would have medical garb in the apartment. A few women said about medical stuff being hanging around the place, leaflets. Some would have been looking after him, like Florence Nightingale almost, and they were cooking him good food, and they'd find the McDonald's wrappers in the bin.
Right. That's a really striking one, the heel protectors on his neck, even coming back from trips with like inconsistent hair, like his eyebrows shaved off,
his
hair in his legs.
Hairy legs. And like, there's loads of detail in the book about things that we won't even get time to discuss. But there's also a lot of things that I know that I didn't put in the book. You know, like, there's just so much. There's just so much there and so many strange things. It's hard to say, like, what was going on exactly.
And the other really
They thought he was a dying man. I should say that.
Yeah.
They thought he was a dying man and they wanted to offer him emotional and financial support.
At the start, and then it becomes sort of quasi-controlling because Alison's friends are telling her, listen, we've heard things about DJ Carey. If you look at the wood from the trees here, this is clearly not a very sick man. And then how that relationship actually ends is that she's outside her friend's funeral, someone who has died of cancer. She's in the car outside the church and she receives a text from DJ saying that the relationship is over. And he knows well that she now knows all the details about what he's been lying about.
And meanwhile, he's already moved on.
Okay, he had.
Yeah.
There's a callousness to that as well. And when he is confronted about it, there is the quest for sympathy that comes from DJ. Every woman has screwed me over in my life, including my mother and sisters, is a quote from DJ. Is that something that he really felt, or is that something that he just told his partners?
I reported what he told his partners. I have no idea what he feels or what he doesn't feel, because a lot of what he says anyway is very questionable.
Yeah. It's a very striking quote. Like, do you think this is a man who had some sort of trauma from whatever happened with his own business beforehand and really carried that in?
Lots of people have trauma. You know, so many people in Ireland listening to this, people who have cancer, who are actually undergoing treatment, who are going through radiation treatment, chemotherapy, people in our families, people, friends of ours. And DJ was giving graphic details to people so he could extract money from them, people he knew. He was talking about stuff like getting his spleen out, getting his full body flushed out with blood transfusions. And like, I don't even, like, the graphic detail he went into, I don't understand how, like, it was stomach churning stuff. Like, I sat down with Tommy Butler and he told me, like, he showed me the text messages between them, And he just said, Emer, like the detail, he felt sick one day after talking to him. And he felt so sorry for him. He just couldn't believe he didn't have cancer. This was just unfathomable that DJ didn't have cancer. That even when the Gardaí called him in to take a statement and to tell him he'd been duped, he still didn't believe DJ. He believed DJ had cancer, and most of the people I've spoken to believed till the very last minute that he had cancer. It was only when the Gardaí categorically assured them DJ never had cancer, he's never been to Seattle, that he had admitted that to the Gardaí, that he was in fact healthy. They found that really hard to believe. Successful people, high profile people, business people. And like the judge said, you know, they weren't foolish. They were generous and they were kind, and their hero was dying.
We had a victim impact statement from Dennis O'Brien. There were a number of loans from O'Brien to him. There was a leasing of an apartment in Balls Bridge to him. While he's in Balls Bridge, he's hanging out with Tom the Con, which
I'm glad you picked up on that one. That's a little side story. But yeah, he was a guy that Joe Duffy and Liveline listeners would remember, Tom the Con. But he was a fraudster, like a kind of ordinary scammer that went around the country running up bills in B&Bs and hotels and leaving a trail of unpaid bills behind him. And just seems kind of strange, again, odd, that DJ would hang out with Tom the Con, and they were seen having lunch together, having tea together. DJ would go to his apartment, spoke to people in the area that had seen them together. But at some stage, they had a falling out. So I don't know what happened there. But DJ was really annoyed with Tom the Con, and something about putting stuff in a letterbox, and I don't know, there was a falling out, and let's just say their relationship broke down, their friendship broke down. So I was just fascinated. I wonder what they discussed. Was it hurling? Who knows? Was it fraud stories? I don't know. Was it deception? But here's a convicted criminal, and DJ Carey's having tea with him in his apartment and hanging out around Baggot Street with him.
Yeah, it's fairly careless stuff if he's trying to keep a low profile on that front. But in terms of the stories that he told, like as I mentioned, you're talking to a billionaire. So he'd have these sophisticated stories about how there might be an insurance payout on the way. And
medical negligence case, compo pending.
Yes, so that'd be six-figure sums that he'd be able to get out of people. But then he'd also have just as much of an appetite, it seems, to swindle somebody out of 100 quid.
Or a tenner.
Or a tenner.
Yeah, it's all of the above. It's the different story to match the net worth that I started to realise there was three stories that would pop up. So there was the regular, I'm fundraising for cancer, I'm not well, and he'll accept anything basically. And then there was the, I have the elite sporting status from my handball, so I get free medical treatment in the US, but I have a shortfall. The treatment's covered, but I need the cost of the flights. That could be, say, anything from 3 to 6K. And then for the higher net worth individual, he needed to settle with the banks so that they couldn't get their hands on the compo when it landed from his medical negligence case. So in those cases, he was looking for over 100 grand.
And then what would be the go-to story for a tenner?
Just running with the simple story. I'm sick and I'm fundraising for my cancer. I forgot my wallet. Oh, I left my credit card. Like all those stories, even on dates, like forgot his wallet on a first date. Things like that. Also, I spoke to a really good source, because this has brought me to many people's homes, and really grateful to them for opening the door, saying come on in. And they were nervous, I get it, absolutely. So this one person said to me they used to give him 2 to 3K to tie him over the weekend in cash, and he paid back in cash. But what they found extraordinary was how he would need that much money to get through the weekend. And it was just so, you know, cover the hotel stay or whatever. So obviously he wasn't staying in the budget hotels or but it seems like a lot of money for a weekend.
Was it simply that he just wanted to live a lavish lifestyle without having to graft?
Some people say that. They think there was a bit of that there, that he was never dedicated to work. Like he had jobs over the years, sales jobs, but something would happen, he'd be on the sick or something. You know, there was always a bit of malingering there. He wasn't diligent enough to stay at anything. Obviously, he was very dedicated to hurling now. He turned up for the train and all that. That is absolute. But in terms of his work record, it's patchy.
Mm-hmm. And do we think the money has just been injected into lavish trips to like the Masters and things like that, and it's just not accounted for, or was there something else at play?
The really interesting thing for me, and the main question for me, is what did he do with all the money?
Yeah.
Because there are some things I don't have answers for, didn't have access to his bank statements, but also I'm so aware that a lot of this wheeling and dealing was in cash.
Yes.
So, like, there's no doubt about it. DJ Carey was an extraordinary sportsman. He was incredible. And there was so much respect for him as a hurler. But he has a very dark side. And I think the people who he betrayed have seen that now. And the judge laid it bare for everybody, saying his reputation has been totally destroyed. It's very hard to see a way back from all of this. But as for what he did with the money, there's evidence of high life, but there's also evidence of low life. There's evidence of sitting in the dark, hiding from, you know, bailiffs are about to call, and he had a couple of phones on the go. He seemed really stressed. People were always ringing him, looking for money back. You know, there's evidence of that. I've talked to people who've been in his company that notice things like that.
The case didn't go to trial in the end. The guilty plea from DJ earlier this summer, I guess, ensured that a lot of the details that are in the book are details that maybe you would have had before the summer, and he's preserved the public from knowing about anything else that might have come out.
Yeah, I think it's really important that we put some facts on the record, and it's important because when he pleaded guilty, it came very late in the day. Now, guilty plea, the judge said, still a guilty plea.
Yeah.
So it counts. But by the time it came, you see, you avoid really getting the full picture. And I was thinking, does that mean then that this narrative will continue? Poor DJ. Sure, 'twas only the banks and the wealthy. That's not the case. I've outlined the story of Tommy Butler, of Mag Kerwin, some of the extraordinary people involved, people who were courageous enough. They didn't go reporting DJ, by the way, to the Gardaí. They didn't turn on DJ. The Gardaí came calling to them. They saw their details in his bank transactions after there was an unusual, suspicious transaction flagged by a bank. A vulnerable person was about to transfer a large sum of money to DJ Carey, and the banks contacted the Gardaí. The Gardaí then got his bank statements, secured them, and were able to see all these transfers. And then they contacted people that had transferred money to Carey. And from there, they had to ask people to come to the Garda station and give a statement. So this is tough. It's a tough story because you're talking about people who know people, and the betrayal is immense. The pain is there. People on the ground know each other. It's very hard, and people related to him, I've no doubt. But what's the alternative? Do we turn a blind eye and say that crimes like this, you know, there is a justice system. He's got a sentence now, 5.5 years. And I think that the victims are satisfied, at least, that process, and fair play to the Gardaí in Waterford, by the way, to bring it to that conclusion. But I think they're happy, if you can use that word. I mean, it's bittersweet, but that at least there's some accountability now for his crimes.
Eamon Eve Raynon, it's an amazing piece of work. Jaw-dropping, as I say. The detail is incredible, and it is called The Dodger, DJ Carey and the Great Betrayal. Thanks so much, Eamon, for coming in this afternoon.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.